Well, you've made it for about 48 hours. Congratulations. You've come here to practice something called insight meditation or vipassana. What is it? Simply put, vipassana means to see clearly, to see and understand what's going on, to see things as they are, to see things as they are both inside you and outside you, to see things accurately. And when you see accurately, it can be said that you have wisdom. But that can be a little tricky, this seeing accurately. I mean, the Buddha taught for 45 years, exploring all kinds of different pedagogical methods with the expressed intent of helping his students to see accurately. Think about it. Think about the many layers of conditioning that make up who you are, that affect your ability to see clearly. Maybe we could say that DNA is like the deepest substrata of your conditioning. The eons of evolutionary experience that are encoded into you both physically and psychically. And layered upon all that distant stuff is your family of origin, for better or worse. All the conditioning that came out of that. Then conditioning from your neighborhood. And conditioning from the region. And finally, the conditioning of the nation state that we landed in. Now, throw in the effects of any trauma that you might have endured, and all the formal and informal education that you've received, and your meditation practice, let's not forget that. And you're, each of you are proverbially that unique snowflake. Nobody's the same, not even close. And if you want to take it a step further and get out into past lives, woo-woo land, you know, some people may refer to it, but if you're inclined to believe that, think about all those conditionings. And now we're pushing the infinite. All this, this vast array of variables make up and color the lenses that you see through. So when you sit down to do this thing, vipassana, to try and see clearly, you're naturally often met with this rush of conditioned history. It's like whoosh. All kinds of emotions, thoughts, body sensations. And no doubt, so far, and I'm sure on most of you on occasion, have just been carried away by these. Just tumbled and carried away. Completely lost, totally identified. Sit here, time goes by, the bell rings, and you go, what? Was that meditation? So if seeing clearly is an important part or mostly what this practice is about, how do you start? What skills do you need to be able to see clearly? This is from Ajahn Chah. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. Try to be mindful. Okay, check. Let things take their own natural course. Maybe not fighting with nature so much. A mind becoming still. That would be nice. Seeing the nature of all things. The happiness of the Buddha. Where do I sign up? I love this little quote because it lays out the whole trajectory of our practice. It offers encouragement toward that soft, relaxed, receptive, alert acceptance of experience. There's no sense of resistance or push in that little passage. Let me read it one more time. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. Now, the first step to this soft, relaxed receptivity is pretty simple. And those of you who have been to a number of these retreats know that there is some order to the madness here. First thing we try to establish is that little bit of settling of the mind, and that's what we've done these last 2 days. You know, we encourage you to arrive, not just physically and literally, but arrive in every moment, to come home in the body. In James Joyce's short story, The Dubliners, he refers to his main character like this. Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. I mean, I think you can all relate to that. So arriving is the start. When your mental body is projected into the future or the past, there's a kind of unsettlement to that. It can be gross or it can be pretty subtle. But there is an unsettledness. Sometimes it feels like agitation. Just notice when you're out of the body like that, planning or worrying about the future or rehashing the past or fantasizing something. Doesn't matter whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. There is most often a little bit of disconnect, restlessness, unsettledness, feeling a little bit off. When we're out of the body like that, we are off. We're off the body. And those of you who have been practicing for a while can sense the difference in that. We try to point it out in our instructions, our meditation instructions. Notice the difference between that embodied presence and that incongruent out-of-body sense, which at best is some kind of vagueness or spaciness and kind of discombobulation of our life force in a way. And at worst, it can feel like a frenzied overwhelm. And that being out is less conducive to deep seeing, to clear seeing. And it's also less conducive to the arising of compassion. So the very first thing is to come home. So once Mr. Duffy arrives in the body, the next opportunity or challenge is the stilling and collecting of the mind. And that's known as samadhi. Buddha often referred to the three pillars of the practice: sila, samadhi, and panya. With sila being the first pillar, the ethical pillar, cultivating actions, words, and thoughts that are not harmful to yourself or others, kind of the Gandhian principle. And most of you, I would imagine, are well-developed in sila. Those of you that I know are well-developed in sila. It's something you're continuing to examine, the ethics in your life, as you move from one situation to another. The second pillar, which is the main focus of this talk, is samadhi. which is the ability to have some focus of mind, the undistracted quality of mind. It's a working unity of mind. I stress the working. We'll get to that later. A collection of energy focused enough so that you can penetrate deeply into the experience and see more clearly the way things really are. It's a tool. Now, the usual translation of samadhi is concentration. But that's a little weak. I think it's a lot weak, actually. Samadhi is much broader, richer, stronger, and carries an ethical component with it that the English translation concentration just doesn't hold. So let's look a little deeper into samadhi and see if we can get a feel for it. When the mind is unified, when samadhi is cooking to some degree, there are actually 34 mental factors that have arisen together. And they all arise together, but they can be discerned individually with practice. Now, I'm not going to go over every one of them tonight, bore you to tears. I'll mention a handful, and I'll allude to a bunch of other ones. But just to give you a little feeling, here's a few of the mental factors that are part of the constellation of factors that make up samadhi. If you feel into them while I say them, I think you'll get a sense of their uplifting quality and how together they might calm and focus the mind. There is equanimity. There's tranquility. There is a lightness of mind. There is a flexibility of mind. There is an adaptability of mind. There is non-greed in the mind. There's non-hatred in the mind. There's the sensibility of conscience in the mind. A sense of what is right, what is wrong. Not wanting to harm. There's a sense of proficiency in the mind. That's the sense of a skilled mind aiming at wholesomeness over and over, steady toward wholesomeness. There's rectitude in the mind, an uprightness. It's the honesty of a mind unable to be deceitful. There's a measure of faith in the mind, that the mind can be trusted. There's a good measure of mindfulness in the mind. You get a feeling for this bundle? Do you see why samadhi is so much more than just concentration? There's beauty and an ethical sensibility about samadhi. A thief can have concentration, but he can't have samadhi. Now, when the mind begins to collect, there are some other factors that stand out. The first of these factors is called initial application. It's vitakka in Pali. It refers to the capability you have of consciously and deliberately placing your mind on a chosen object of your experience. The breath, sounds, etc. You've all been working in there. When you balance your checkbook, or when you're trying to remember a detailed story that you're trying to relate to a friend, or you're sitting here in meditation and your mind is gone somewhere and you wake up and then you gently and lovingly bring your mind back. In all those instances, you are exercising initial application. You're taking charge of the mind's attention. It's like the contact that this striker makes when I first hit the bell. It's that contact with experience, that aiming of attention. Now, having directed our mind at that chosen object, whatever it is, another mental factor is needed to hold it there. And that mental factor is called sustained application. Makes sense? By now in this retreat, you've noticed there's all kinds of distracting forces that pull you in different directions and make sustaining that application a bit of a challenge. And I've come to think of these kind of distractions in a little more positive light, actually. And it can be frustrating. You know, we're trying to collect the mind and it keeps running all over the place. And the shop talk word for it is monkey mind, jumping around like a monkey in a tree. But that ability to jump around like that, to have the mind jump around like that, to scan the environment for all kinds of different things, is a survival capability. It's a survival skill. The ability to scan a rapidly changing environment for the things needed for continued survival. That's hardwired in. Monkey mind is hardwired in. You know, we're scanning for, if we cut through it all, we're scanning for food, security, sex, comfort. So on one level, the monkey mind's our pal. Has been for a long time. But as you know, there's something to be gained by exercising the ability to hold the mind on something long enough so we can fully understand it. So sustained application is like the sustain of the bell. And what we're doing on this retreat, we're finding different ways to encourage that initial and sustained application so that they work together and help train and discipline the mind just a little bit. You know, for the application in certain practices. Awareness of the breath, the body, sound, even open awareness. Guided heart meditation. And another thing you might have noticed is that on those occasions when you're able to string together just a moment or two of undistracted mind moments, that it actually feels kind of nice. I'm not talking about a long period of time. Literally, just a few undistracted breaths begins to alter your physiology. And that growing steadiness of mind will manifest itself as a pleasant feeling oftentimes. A little bit of an uplifted heart. It can be a sweet, relaxed kind of joy. And you also might notice that the body, and some people have mentioned it in the interviews today, that, gee, I've been able to concentrate a little bit and then I don't kind of feel my body so much anymore. It gets so light, I hardly feel it. As the mind begins to be able to collect a little bit, sometimes you'll notice that, or you may notice that aches and pains that you sat down with, they might dim out or they may even disappear for a short period of time. Does this make sense to you? Have you had any of those moments? Anybody? So this is the natural progression of samadhi. As the mind collects, it results in joy and happiness in the mind, the body, the heart. And in Pali, this lightness and joy and mental happiness is called piti and sukha. They co-arise together. Now, without these little hits of occasional hits of peace and joy and happiness, we probably wouldn't stick with this practice very long. And I know some of you are just trying to get some traction. I talk about peace and joy and happiness, you're saying, what? Just hang in there. I mean, there's got to be a reward here. I mean, where's our cookies? And the Buddha knew this too. That's why he emphasized samadhi so much. He wanted his students to experience this, the pleasures of samadhi. I mean, Buddhist practice is not designed to be some dour, difficult, painful process. There are times when it is like that. But that's not its design. But it does take a little time to get some traction. So just have patience. Hang in there. You can be the only people who are not successful at a meditation practice are those who give up. And that's the truth. The third pillar, just briefly, panya, is the translation is wisdom. It's that clarity of seeing that comes about through leading a life of sila, an ethical life, as the foundation, and cultivating, having a mind that learns to be present in a kindly, undistracted way. And this clear seeing that is wisdom is always, at its deepest level, combined with an opening of the heart. That can't be helped. The heart mind that clearly sees the origin of suffering in itself and in others is naturally and unfailingly inclined to greater and greater compassion and loving kindness. It's an immutable law of nature. Deeper seeing results in greater compassion. It's quite beautiful. I look at samadhi as kind of the engine of practice. It channels wholesome energy towards very tangible benefits. The Buddha took significant time and energy teaching about samadhi. He encouraged his students to develop it to greater and greater levels, depths. And many of you are, and if any of you have read the discourses, samadhi is shot through the discourses. And certainly the many lists that have come down to us, samadhi appears prominently. This is just a quick sampling. You might not be familiar with the two lists I'm going to bring to your mind. The first one is called the five controlling factors. Another way of looking at these factors is these are the factors that make up willpower. And the Buddha felt that it was important to have a balanced measure of these five factors: faith, effort, mindfulness, samadhi, and understanding. Faith that your energy expended will actually lead to some benefit. And in terms of meditating, that you have at least some trust in the teachings of the Buddha, enough trust to give it a try. You know, enough trust to get off your tush. Maybe in this case it's to get on your tush. But you've all had enough faith to come here and try this. Effort. It's essential, of course, in doing everything. And there's a whole teaching around effort. And effort is one of the factors on the Eightfold Path. You know, what is appropriate effort? What is inappropriate effort? There's a whole teaching around that. Mindfulness. Hugh spoke about it eloquently last night. The ability to be present with what's happening, when it's happening, without too much resistance. And samadhi, collecting the mind on our chosen object. And understanding. A mature, clear seeing of the way things really are. An understanding of how and why we suffer. And how that suffering can be reduced or eliminated. An understanding, a deep, visceral understanding of impermanence. And a clearer seeing of who we are and who we aren't. Another cool list that I like, that developed by the Buddha, that maybe you haven't come across, is called the Four Bases of Success. The Four Bases of Success. Sounds like a modern self-help book, doesn't it? You know, if the Buddha was alive today, he could make a fortune in the self-help business running really expensive, groovy retreats. He could charge a lot of money. He could title them things like Bliss Forever or End Your Suffering Now or the 8 Easy Steps to Enlightenment. You know, you can almost picture him sitting on Oprah, next to Oprah. You know? Today we have our guest, the Buddha, also known as Siddhartha, also known as Shakyamuni. He'll share with us his latest work entitled The Four Bases of Success. Say, Shakyamuni, before you talk about the four bases of success in that middle path you discovered, I know our audience is dying, just dying to find out how you lost all that weight during your pre-middle path period of starvation, fasting, and self-mortification. Just how did you do it? Was it a juice fast? Low carb? Herbal cleansing? Or what? So the four bases of success: desire, energy, samadhi, and investigation. It's the wholesome kind of desire to accomplish something of benefit to you or others, like developing your meditation practice or finding ways to reduce the suffering in the world. Energy, again, needed in appropriate measure. Samadhi, the trained mind that'll stay where we aim it. And investigation. It's what we do with that steady, patient mind. You talked about it last night, that direct experience, that visceral experience in that exploration of our world, of the phenomena in our world. And Hugh also mentioned last night that samadhi also appears on the seven factors of enlightenment. Samadhi also appears as one of the factors in the Eightfold Path. So I think you get the point. The importance of samadhi is just shot through the whole teaching. So there's three categories of samadhi. Now we're going to get a little technical, so just hang with me, or tune out if you wish. But Buddhist discipline distinguishes between the quality of samadhi developed through the continuity of mindfulness, of changing perceptions. That's kind of like our basic Vipassana practice. We'll talk a little more about this. And the quality of samadhi developed through placing our mind in a single focus on a single object. There's some confusion about samadhi. So as you work yourself in this practice, it's good to know the difference in the playing field here. And one way we can begin to explore this, let's just do a short 2-minute meditation together. You can just be relaxed where you are. Close your eyes. Settle in. And bring your attention to the breath. And as you rest your attention there, notice all the changing sensations in the breath. The full inhale and exhale. And pay precise attention to all the fleeting sensations in the breath. Is there tingling? Pressure during the movement? What about heat or cold? Is there vibration? What's the rhythm of the breath? Do you pause at the ends of the breath? Or is it continuous? Is the breath long or short? Is it shallow or deep? Okay, open your eyes. A lot of things are happening there. That's an example of a continuity of mindfulness of changing perceptions. You're exploring different aspects of the breath. And working with breath, of course, is just one possibility. In your practice, you expand the mindfulness to include everything that happens in your life. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, thoughts, they're all grist for the mill. And by paying meticulous attention like this over time, the mind is naturally brought to a state of greater clarity. It allows you to see the impermanence and the empty phenomena of the emptiness of phenomena. Things just kind of come and go, changing all the time. Emotions, thoughts, sounds, body sensations. as you continue to pay attention in this way, from one to the next, mindfulness and samadhi naturally increase. And the concentration that develops through this mindfulness, like this continuity of mindfulness, is called momentary samadhi. The mind momentarily collects itself, aiming at one object. It's there for a while. And then it disperses and moves to another. And then collects, and then disperses and moves to another. That's the momentary samadhi. It's one time. But before you, it's an important level of samadhi, because before you are able to aim your mind like that, one thing to the next, the mind just runs all over the place. An example of that, of a mind running loose. I mean, right now I'm sitting up here, I do have a little crick in my back. If the mind runs loose with that, it can go something like that. Oh, there's a crick in my lower back. Uh-oh, I wonder if it's all of a sudden going to pull and tear. I've had that happen before. I remember when it happened, I was working out at the health club and a couple of guys had to help me to the PT. And then I had to have a neighbor that helped me get up on the toilet. My buddy Doug had to come over and help move me around. It was just totally horrible. Boy, if that happened here, it'd be really challenging to teach and to move around and keep some kind of a focus. That would be miserable. You know? Oh, and I remember last year, poor Tara, it happened to her, and I saw the suffering and how she had to work her way through that and teach, and maybe it's my turn this time. Oh, is this what getting old and teaching is all about? I mean, is this what it's like? I remember when I used to be younger and I was more supple, and, you know, see what the mind can do? All it is just a little sensation in the back. But it can go forever. It can go for almost weeks like that. But when you're able to build a little mindfulness, a thought chain like that gets discovered pretty early. Another experience, an oration of that, might be, ah, there's a crick in my neck or a crick in my back. There's tightness. There's twisting. There's some heat. Pulsing. There's some fear in the mind. There's an intention to straighten. And there's a little bit of release now in that area. There's a little reduction in the twisting feeling. Fear is diminished a little bit. There's a renewed intention to sit straight. So that's kind of catching on, staying with the bare experience. That's our practice. And it's when we're able to do that, when you're able to do that, it saves you a lot of anguish. Shortens the period of tangle. Allows you to reset in a way into a reflective, accepting presence again. Now, Ajahn Chah compared momentary samadhi with taking a walk and then resting a little bit, taking and walking some more, resting, walking some more, resting. You're on the journey and there's really not much, there's no real disturbance, because in a short time, you continue on that journey. A samadhi can grow very strong through a continuity of mindfulness like this. Can move through stages of intense happiness that really cultivate in deeper wisdom, deep compassion. Because we're directly experiencing the flow of our lives. And we're learning from it. That's what this insight business is about. They come on their own. This is the beauty of Vipassana. Now, there's another way to develop samadhi. In practicing this way, you don't highlight the changing nature of phenomena the way that we just experienced with looking at breathing. You simply place your attention on one object and keep it there. This type of samadhi is called access samadhi, or access to jhana. So let's try another little short demo, another 2-minute meditation. So close your eyes again. We're going to use the breath again. So first settle and locate the breath. Now, bring your attention to the very tip of the nostrils. Rest your attention there. And just pay attention to the breath moving across that single point, not following the breath in or out or paying attention to temperature or anything or vibration, just putting the mind on that point. It's like sawing a log. The saw is moving. You're aware of its occurrence, but your focus is on the saw at the spot where the cutting is happening. And when the mind wanders off that spot, you gently return and begin again at the same spot. Now a little bonus experiment. Bring your attention to a spot that's actually off the skin, between the upper lip and the nostril, but off the skin. Allow your attention to settle there. You know the movement of the breath. That's known. You're not following it. You're sensing it just as it moves across that spot. That's where your attention is. Okay, good. Open your eyes. If you were to continue like this for a period of time and concentration samadhi started to deepen, what you would notice is that the pull of other sensory objects would start to diminish. And what I mean by that is that the sense of your body would start to fade out some, begin to dim. Sounds would begin to dim. There'd be a dimming down of external sounds. Thoughts would start to have longer spaces between them. And the ones that do come wouldn't stick, wouldn't carry you off, wouldn't have much power to move you anywhere. You don't get pulled off the object so easily. And then an interesting thing begins to happen here, if you stayed for a long enough period of time. As the mind collects in on itself and collects more and more, withdraws from sensory experience, the mind actually comes forward as the predominant object, not physical sensations. With sounds and thoughts and sensations receding, there's just the mind. And typically what happens is the mind, as the focus is happening in that area, there is some brightness or a light begins to appear in that area over time. And in the scriptures, in the Abhidhamma and the commentaries, that's known as the light of wisdom. And it simply denotes that concentration is beginning to increase, that samadhi is beginning to strengthen, and that there's going to be the power to penetrate into experience. So with this access to samadhi or access samadhi or access to jhana, we're moving from the perceptions of physicality, sensations, to much more subtle perceptions of refined mental factors. These visions of light or subtle vibrations that are felt. And as this happens, it's very common that there's an experience of pleasure, much deeper mindfulness, happiness, equanimity. It's pretty nice stuff. Ajahn Chah compared access to jhana as wandering about inside your own home. consciousness becomes at ease inside the home, this kind of collected arena of perception. It's relaxed, luminous, comfortable in that area. And with access samadhi, attention doesn't move away from the meditation object. Thinking may still arise, but it's light and wispy. And it generally, what it does, it just circles around the meditative experience. If there are any thoughts, there are generally reflections on the meditation that's happening right there. But the thoughts are so light, they don't disturb the tranquility that's beginning to set in. Now, as this focused attention continues, and the mind stills and stills some more, at some point you enter into what's called meditative absorption. At that point, the mind is utterly focused on its object. Perceptions become even more and more refined. Attention is completely merged into the object. Complete unification. Even if there are strong sounds or strong sensations coming out of the body, the mind remains utterly unmoved. There may or may not even be awareness of the sound or sensation, but the mind remains still. It lets go automatically of the slightest, there is not the slightest ripple in consciousness. The body is then completely tranquilized. You see, we're kind of on a continuum here. Thinking completely stops. Hard to imagine, but thinking completely stops. There's complete rest and a bright alertness of mind. There's rapture, pleasure, equanimity in this increasingly unified, radiant mind. Now, emerging from this jhana, when those mental factors start to unravel, the mind is very light, bright, flexible, wieldy, adaptable. It's pliable. The body feels totally relaxed and rejuvenated. The heart is soft and wide open. A mind that emerges from samadhi like this is very ready to do the work of vipassana, to see clearly, to penetrate deeply into experience. Now, this is the possibility of our practice. I just wanted to share that with you. Just the possibility. It was mentioned in the beginning, Tara mentioned in the beginning, that I spent 5 months of this year in retreat from, and I'm going to share a little bit of that experience. It was from June until mid-November. Now, if you think back, there were some things that happened between June and mid-November. I got my absentee ballot, and I didn't even know who Sarah Palin was. I had no idea. If you stepped off the earth in June and somebody said Sarah Palin to you, unless you were an Alaskan, you had no idea. So I get out, and we've got a new president. There's this thing, this economic collapse happening. The Red Sox did not make it into the World Series, to my chagrin. But we can't win every year. So it was really obvious, this thing of change and impermanence. When I looked at my financial statements, I could see the impermanence. I studied up at the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts, and I studied with a Burmese Sayadaw, which is the title of an exalted teacher, Sayadaw. I had sat a five-week retreat with him. His name is Paul Auk, P-A-A-U-K, two words. So I kind of knew what to expect. He was a monk since he was 9 or 10 years old. He's in his late 70s. And although he's now recognized in Asia as really one of the great teachers and Buddhist scholars, he mostly made his mark in his early years as a practitioner. He spent many, many years in seclusion. He loves to practice. And then they'd asked him to run some monasteries, and he just, took it on. And now during the rains retreat at his main monastery, and there's several that he runs, there are over 2,000 monks and nuns and lay people that cram in there to study with this man for those 3 months each year. And he's recognized by the monastic and lay communities, I'd say throughout the world, as the preeminent teacher of samadhi practices. And that's why I went there, to see what might be possible. And he teaches from the belief that a certain amount of stability of mind is necessary in our spiritual practice in order to really penetrate more deeply what is true. So we were very fortunate to have this opportunity. You know, if you go to Asia, I mean, there's hundreds of people there all the time and thousands. So there was only 30 of us in the forest refuge. 10 of us stayed the whole period of time. Other people came for a month, 2 or 3 months. It was a great opportunity. Burmese people came from all over North America to pay their respects. They came on the weekends in cars, and they stayed nearby in bed and breakfasts, and they cooked them all kinds of Burmese food, and they came to see the great Sayadaw. You know, they wouldn't meditate so much. They'd come and watch him meditate. You know, and it was also kind of cool. I really found that I came to love Burmese food. Because he had some people there that were cooking his home food for him. But the thing about being a monk or a nun is that you can't, like, save food for the next day. It's part of what you do. You just give it away. So he'd have his lunch. You know, they would never eat past noon. So he and the other two monks would have their lunch. And then they'd bring over these little dishes of this amazing stuff. I mean, I didn't know what I was eating or what it was called. And it was incredibly spicy and oily. I mean, maybe it wasn't the most healthy thing, but I found that, hey, I kind of like this. I mean, some of it looked like a bowl of, like, used motor oil with chunks of things in it that could have been, like, dog vomit or whatever. But it tasted wonderful. So he set this schedule. It was a pretty rigorous schedule. It was a suggested schedule. Most people would meditate a lot in the room, because in samadhi practice, you want as much seclusion as you can get and quiet. But he set the schedule. You'd sit for an hour and a half, walk for 45 minutes, sit for an hour and a half, walk for 45 minutes, all day long from 4 o'clock in the morning to 8:30 at night. What was interesting about it over this whole period, he came to that meditation hall for every hour and a half sitting, every single one. And he went through some colds and yuck, and he was there like a monument in front of the room. And he didn't face this way. He faced this way. There was a Buddha, and he just faced the Buddha. So very inspiring. And oftentimes there might be only 2 or 3 people there in the room, because people are working in the rooms. But he wanted to be there to inspire. It was quite wonderful. Interviews were every day. At the end of the day, starting at 5 o'clock, there was one Dharma talk a week on the weekends. And I'm sharing some of this with you because he's going to come back. If his health holds up, I believe he's going to come back in the next year or two. You might want to take this on. The structure of the retreat had 2 parts, at least in the instructions that I got. The first part, and everybody's working individually, was just to sharpen the mind as much as possible, develop what samadhi to the best of my ability. And then the second part was to apply that samadhi to the my mental experiences and my physical experiences in the body. It was a great experience, but there's two learnings from that time that I spent with him that I want to share with you, because I think it'll be a benefit to your practice today. In fact, if you remember anything from this talk, maybe these two things are the most important aspects. If you want to enhance your samadhi, there are 2 obstacles to that you need to come to peace with. And first, when you arrive home in the body, and you take the measure, take the weather, and you determine that there's a lot of restlessness, or there's a lot of wanting, and you're not relaxed, and the heart is kind of shut down, and there's strong sensations of that vein. It's really mostly impossible to try to do single focus samadhi practice. It's not indicated in that situation. So when the heart is closed and there's anxiety or severe restlessness, single focus samadhi is not the practice. But that's no big deal. Just apply the kindly attention to whatever the weather is, whatever is up. That's what we're teaching here day after day. Recognizing what's up, accepting it. Hugh talked about it last night, the rain, recognizing, accept, investigate, become intimate with it. Now, samadhi is still developing. Our concentration is still developing as we're moving through the constellation of fear or whatever is up for us, the different aspects of it. And we're learning as we go. Now, if there is some minor malaise, crankiness or low energy, that's a different story. Maybe we can work with that a little bit. Maybe we can modulate that a little bit. And the Buddha had a bunch of meditations that he taught to his students that had to do with gladdening the mind. And this morning I shared one of those. It was the little bit of considering what we're grateful for, feeling it in the body. Another one is reflecting on your generosity, on your own goodness. Just reflecting on some kind acts that you did. Doesn't have to be big things. Holding a door for somebody. Moving a turtle out of the road. Whatever it might be. Taking a worm off the sidewalk. Doesn't have to be a big deal. But they have the capacity to kind of lift the heart. Another one is reflecting on the qualities of a Buddha. That great compassion. That deep wisdom. And reflecting how those qualities exist in you. Yeah, sometimes they're veiled over by this or that as the other thing. But there is great love and compassion there. There is wisdom. That natural perfection. So after contemplating these, you know, it may be possible to raise, if these are a minor malaise, you may be able to raise and uplift the heart and then you're, in a way, ready for liftoff. At that point, the heart is well equipped. The seedbed is ready, prepped for meditation. Whatever meditation you choose. Whether it's continuity of awareness from one to the other or single focus or loving kindness, you're just more ready. But remember, if the weather is really blustery, don't try to unify the mind on a single object. You'll just tie yourself into knots. I know that from personal experience. The body will revolt. It'll get tighter and tighter. It's a no-no. So keep your eye on that weather vane. The other critical point I want you to remember is that if there is striving in the mind, you'll also be unable to develop samadhi through that single focus practice. Everyone has to come to grips with this. And it's an easy trap to fall into. You hear all these states, these wonderful, pleasant states. I want some of that. I want to focus the mind. It doesn't work like that. It's the cool paradox of this practice. I talk with a number of Western teachers on who have studied with Paul, who spent weeks, these are senior Western teachers who spent weeks in striving, lost in striving. I couldn't, you know, it was my biggest challenge. It was all around striving. Here I was in secluded, being taught by this beautiful being. He was encouraging me, pushing me. Tracking my every mind movement day by day. Probably, I haven't been tracked that closely since I was an infant and I was born and my mother was checking to see that I was still breathing and cleaning and feeding me all day long. In addition to this, I have this strong kind of spiritual desire, had it for a long time. So that's kind of working there. And coupling with the desire to please this beautiful being who's trying to help me, I was primed for striving. And, you know, I tumbled into it. I had to keep catching myself. You know, okay, time out. Now you're striving. The heart would begin to kind of turn to dust. kind of, I would get brittle. I'd have to back off. You know, and you can actually find yourself when you're striving, you're kind of leaning forward a little bit. Just kind of relax back. Start again. Maybe do a loving kindness or one of those gladdening practices. And sometimes things would clear and I'd go on. Sometimes I have to get up and go for a walk, do some yoga, have some tea. And you're in the same position here. You know, kind of judging that space, knowing when to back off, developing your artistry of practice. So those two things, just examining to see whether the heart is open, gladdened, bright, uplifted. And is there an absence of striving? And if you're kind of clear in those two directions, then some single focus samadhi for a portion of your meditation might be beneficial. So tonight I tried to give you some sense of what samadhi is, its importance in the scheme of practice, how it comes about. And in ending, it's just good to remember that like everything else in creation, samadhi is impermanent. Those mental factors that come together, they come apart. They're supposed to. That's nature. So you have these sittings at times where you just feel uplifted and the heart's open, and then you sit down again and you think it's going to happen and it doesn't happen. That's just nature. Things come together, things come apart. Samadhi's not to be grasped at. It's not an end in itself. It's not liberation in any way. The gentle process of cultivating samadhi is part of the process of making the mind your friend. When the mind is trained and befriended, it becomes remarkably supportive to you on this journey of life. And like a good friend, the mind is steady, it's patient, flexible. It's adaptive. It supports you in your growth, in your full flowering. It supports your seeing clearly. And through that clear seeing, your heart just naturally opens. Another way to conceive of samadhi is that it's like nurturing a small seedling. Can't be rushed or pushed in any way. But given the proper protection from the strong elements, the right soil, water, and sunlight, nature will do the trick. You don't have to do anything. And so it is with your practice. The same gentleness you would apply for caring for that small seedling, that same gentleness is the foundation of our practice. Valuing and taking time to be in seclusion, your daily practice, occasionally coming to more intensive retreats like this. And tonight we took a glance at some of the potential fruit, some of the wonderful fruit of this practice, a vision of what is possible. And so I want to close with just a few lines from a book written by René Dumont, written a while ago. It's called Mount Analog. And the book's really an allegory. It's about a journey up a mountain. And the mountain represents the spiritual journey of understanding. And he wrote this: keep your eye fixed on the top, but don't forget to look right in front of you. The last step depends on the first. Don't think you're there just because you see the summit. Watch your footing. Be sure of the next step, but don't let that distract you from the highest goal, because the first step depends upon the last. Our sense, our vision of what is possible is actually what brings us here, whether we're cognizant of it or not. So even as we pay attention to this step, the next step, we don't have to lose sight of the vision of what's possible. Because sometimes that vision is the source of our energy and our motivation. So thank you for your attention. Let's just sit for a for a moment.